You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter, in today for Rob Ferret. Now, what we know today as family court started more than 100 years ago as juvenile court. It was a progressive reform referred to as the Great Idea. In the years since, the scope of that system has grown a lot. Today, having a hand in the foster system, custody disputes, child protection, and more. It affects millions of people, but has largely escaped scrutiny. Our next guest says the system is doing more harm for families than good, and it needs to be replaced with something else. We want to hear from you in this conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you or a loved one been involved with family court for juvenile justice, foster care, adoption, or something else? What was the experience like? What do you think needs to change? And do you work in the family court system? If so, what do you see working and what's not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Jane M. Spinnick is a clinical professor emerita of law at Columbia Law School. She specializes in juvenile justice, child advocacy, and family court reform. Her new book is called The End of Family Court: How Abolishing the Court Brings Justice to Children and Families. Jane, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
Can you bring us back to the beginning when the idea was juvenile court? What was that system meant to address when it started?
The juvenile court began at the beginning of the 20th century, actually 1899 in Chicago, where the first court was founded. And the idea of the court was that a benevolent judge, using informality and a lot of discretion, would help families and help children, so-called fix them, in a social court. So a place that really didn't have much due process. The judge and maybe a probation officer or a social worker would try to figure out why a child was getting into trouble or why a family couldn't take care of their children and try to problem solve, try to fix what was wrong. I think it's important to recognize that at the time this was going on in the major cities of the Northeast and the Midwest, where millions of immigrants, most of them impoverished, were flooding into the cities. And so the families that the court intended to fix were not the earlier white settlers, but these immigrants who came from Southern and Eastern Europe, had very different customs, culture, language, approaches to life, and were deeply impoverished. And so many of the reformers believed that what they needed was to be made into, quote, proper Americans, and saw the court as one of the ways to do that, particularly when things were particularly bad for a family. So some of the ideas that the reformers had, like kindergartens and libraries and settlement houses, all had quite a positive spin to them. But the juvenile court, though it was set up to fix them, was often seen by the immigrants as punitive.
And how do we get from the point where it was a juvenile court system to what it is now, handling so much of family business and family life? How does it change into family court?
Well, it takes almost a century to do that. At the beginning, the kinds of cases that came into the family court were not so different than the kinds that come in today. The difference really was that the court itself didn't see a difference. So when children might have broken the law, what we call juvenile delinquency, when children get into trouble, but they haven't really broken the law, they've just misbehaved, and because they are under 18, they can still be brought to court. That was part of delinquency at the beginning, and now it is a separate category of young people called status offenses. The status is their age. and then what was called then dependency, and we now call neglect and abuse. So the court dealt with those kinds of issues and also dealt with issues concerning custody, paternity, support. And over time, as these different areas of law became categorized separately and different causes of action, the court continued to expand so that today it encompasses, in most jurisdictions, all of those issues. In some jurisdictions, also divorce and other matrimonial issues.
And you mentioned something earlier, due process. And I was really surprised to read in your book that in the early years of juvenile court, family court, it was acknowledged by some that due process wasn't really compatible with what they were trying to do. Can you talk about that idea of due process and what it's looked like over the years in the court?
Sure. There was no due process in the early court. The whole idea was that either the child or the parent was exchanging this benevolent help for what would otherwise be, at the time, due process in another court. Over the course of the century, as people began to recognize that this court was not achieving what it was supposed to be achieving, which was to diminish juvenile delinquency and recidivism, help families. And when it wasn't doing that in that way, there was much more concern that this bargain that had been made was not really occurring, and that maybe young people and their families needed more due process. By the 1960s, when the Supreme Court was really looking hard at due process for both adults and young people, it began to scrutinize the juvenile court a great deal. And the classic example of that is a case called In re Galt, where a young child, really a 14-year-old, Gerald Galt, allegedly made a lewd phone call without any due process, not a lawyer, not witnesses, not even notice of what the charges were. He got sent to the Arizona Reform School for 6 years. Fortunately, there was an ACLU lawyer in Arizona in the 1960s who got the ACLU to take that all the way up to the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court, Justice Fortas in particular, really railed at this court for providing young people with absolutely no chance to prove that they had not done what they had been charged with doing, and that essentially the court was the worst of both worlds. It was neither benevolent nor was it providing due process. So that was the beginning of what came to be called fundamental fairness in juvenile court and later in the expanded family court, where young people were given many more, though not quite all, the due process rights that adults had. Unfortunately, while that is what was supposed to happen, as recently as during the Obama administration, there were many studies done by the Department of Justice, the Federal Department of Justice, finding that many juvenile and family courts remain stuck in the pre-Galt era, giving very little due process to young people, and really almost forgetting that that was their obligation. And so many jurisdictions ended up coming under federal mandates to provide counsel to young people, to make sure they had the rights they're supposed to have. And these were only in places where the administration saw very clearly what the problems were, but there are many places around the country where this continues.
We're talking with Jane M. Spinnick right now, a clinical professor emerita of law at Columbia Law School, talking about her new book, The End of Family Court, How Abolishing the Court Brings Justice to Children and Families. You can join in, too, with your questions, your comments, your experiences with the family court system at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter. We continue our talk with Jane M. Spinnick from Columbia Law School about her new book, The End of Family Court, How Abolishing the Court Brings Justice to Children and Families. And Jane, you write in the book that when you started in on this book, you didn't think about, you didn't plan on saying that the court should be abolished. Where did you start to change your mind? What is it about the family court system that you think needs doing away with?
Well, you're right. When I started, I really did believe that the court could be made into a better version of itself. I kept thinking that with less discretion for the judges and more due process, maybe it could work well. There were a few things that changed my mind. The first was digging down into the history of the court over about 125 years now, and seeing that the kinds of problems we face in the court today are the same kinds of problems that were faced throughout the history, often with the same solutions proposed and then rejected. So it has always been a court for poor people. It increasingly became a court disproportionately for people of color, especially Black, and later in the century, Native Americans. And early on, really very early on, even supporters of the court, but often also scholars outside of the court, began identifying that many of the issues that the families had could be solved in their communities, that they did not have to be brought into court, that so much of what brought them into court was their poverty, the segregated communities they lived in, the lack of housing, of proper childcare, of good schools, many of the same things we say today. But those concerns were consistently answered by the court itself, especially the judges, as, well, society's never going to do that, so they're better off coming into court. And if you just give us some more resources and you give us more judges, we'll fix those problems. But the truth is, the court has never been able to do that. The suggestion that more resources and more judges would make a difference has been proven wrong over and over again through this century. There were lots more resources and lots more judges, and it hasn't helped the families. It has really drawn out from the community resources that might have made a difference if the community could themselves have helped to develop the kinds of supports and mutual aid that could support families when they especially needed it. The other thing that really changed my perspective was in the last two decades, there has been an increasing advocacy by impacted families and youth, parents and young people with lived experience in the juvenile legal system, in the family regulation, what most people think of as the child welfare system, within the foster care system. there has been a lot of speaking out about the harm that has been caused to generations of families involved in these systems. And that advocacy has really helped me see my role as a professional in the system differently, as someone who really needs to listen hard to what these families are saying. And that has come kind of hand in hand with the idea that abolition is not just about tearing down or you know, letting people out of prison. Abolition is really a mindset about how we can support people better in ways that have not proven to be so punitive. How can we keep children safe in their families by supporting them in their communities? So all of those things came together for me, and it led me to look really hard at how this court could be shrunk and eventually eliminated so that the only cases that should be in court are those that are really legal cases. So, for example, I think it's important for your listeners to know that only about 20% of any of the cases that ultimately reach the family court in child protection are about serious harms to children, whether they're physical or sexual or, you know, extreme neglect like starvation or the failure to give essential medical care. Everything else is either about poverty or other structural inequalities. So we investigate millions of children every year, and yet only about 500,000 of them ever even reach the family court. But those investigations, which are mostly screened out, are very disruptive to families and end up treating families in ways that make families unwilling to seek help because they are so afraid of being reported. Even if those reports never become cases in a court, they undermine the ability of parents or young people to trust people like their teachers, like their doctors, like their other healthcare workers. And so we actually undermine helping families by having a massive system that doesn't actually keep children safe or keep them happy and healthy in their families.
It is a massive system. One stat that you wrote about that really drove it home for me was that 1 in 3 children nationwide and over half of Black children will experience a child protection investigation by the time they reach 18 years old. I mean, that's a pretty stark number.
It's a ridiculous number. And as I just was discussing, most of those investigations are terribly disruptive. They scare people, of course, but most of them don't end up in finally reaching the court. And so, nor do they end up with providing the services that these families need. And yet we spend about, at last count, about $34 billion on these systems, almost half of which goes for out-of-home care for those numbers of children who eventually reach court and are placed away from their families. Mm-hmm. If we took that $15 billion and spread it around in communities, it is much more likely that children will be safe within their families, because as we found during the worst of the pandemic, when impoverished families get more money and they don't have to worry as much about evictions, and they get some mutual aid from their communities, there was less findings of abuse and neglect during that period of time.
Yeah, I am curious, Jane, sorry to interrupt, but in our last minute or so here, if the court would be shrunken, would be done away with, what do you imagine kind of taking its place?
Well, the biggest thing that will take its place is community-based services, where most people can get the supports they need, whether it's substance use treatment, mental health, regular health treatment, better funded schools. All of these things would make a huge difference. For those small number of cases that still have a legal issue that we want people to have due process for, they can be part of our current judicial system without having a separate court that still believes it's doing good. At least the other courts in the system recognize that at best they're doing some justice, but they're not pretending that they're doing good.
Well, Jane, thanks for sharing this with us today and taking some time to talk with us.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Jane M. Spinnick is a clinical professor emerita of law at Columbia Law School. She specializes in juvenile justice, child advocacy, and family court reform. We've been talking with her about her new book, The End of Family Court: How Abolishing the Court Brings Justice to Children and Families. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the railroads were a big part of Wisconsin's growth as a state. Today, some old rail lines carry hikers and bikers instead of trains. We'll learn more about the history of railroads in the state and the birth of the rails to trails movement here. Plus, ice used to be a valuable commodity in Wisconsin. An author shares her book about how ice and refrigeration changed our lives and tells the story of the Great Lakes Ice Wars. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, a longtime journalist shares her thoughts about how the media should do better at covering the possibility of a second Donald Trump presidency. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter, in today for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Less than a year out now from the 2024 presidential election, newsrooms are in the preliminary stages of campaign coverage. There's decades of muscle memory that results in many outlets putting together the same old horse race style reporting as we lead up to and tick off primary after primary. However, Donald Trump, widely talked about as the presumptive Republican nominee for president, is an unprecedented candidate. The former president is currently facing 91 criminal charges across state and federal cases. And we also know, thanks to reporting from the Washington Post and others, that Trump and his associates have been developing alarming plans for a second term that would consolidate executive power, weaponize the Justice Department against his political opponents, and invoke the Insurrection Act to have the military respond to protests. Our next guest says not enough people know about these risks of a second Trump presidency and that the news media are dropping the ball when it comes to talking about them. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. How aware are you of Trump's plans for an actual second term? What have you been reading, hearing, or seeing from the news coverage about Trump's plans for retribution against his political opponents? What do you want to see the media do differently when it comes to covering Trump? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Margaret Sullivan is a Guardian U.S. columnist where she writes on media, politics, and culture. She was previously the Washington Post media columnist and the New York Times public editor. Margaret, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with you.
Well, before we get into specific recommendations for media, I just want to reflect a bit on that type of horse race coverage that we're familiar with. Reacting to a poll, making that kind of a story in itself. Why do you think that type of political coverage has been so persistent over the years?
You know, I think it's easy. That's part of it. It's very easy to do a story about a poll. You know, there's numbers. You can say they're neck and neck or this person's pulling ahead or not. It doesn't really require a lot of reporting. It doesn't require a lot of thought. and it's kind of knee-jerk. Now, I'm not saying that journalists are lazy, but it's a way to do an interesting story that doesn't really require any kind of, real reporting energy or much staff. So it's a very easy kind of thing to do. And it's the kind of thing we've been doing for a long time, so we know how to do it.
Yeah. Do you think it made perhaps more sense in a pre-Trump era, or did it always need a bit of refreshing?
It never was great journalism, but I think that in the pre-Trump era, you basically had, for many years, two candidates, two different parties, two candidates who had different positions on things, but they were both kind of in the tradition of normal politics. But with Trump, especially as we head into this, what would be a second term, not a second consecutive term, but a second term for him, the kinds of plans that he's hatching really mean that the coverage needs to change. So that horse race coverage, there's a place for it, but I don't think it should dominate the way it generally does.
And thanks to some reporting that's been done and from the Heritage Foundation's so-called Project 2025 documents, we do know something about the plans for a second Trump presidency should he be elected. Just to set the stage here, what are some of the things that you see the media not talking about enough when it comes to that?
So we know about these kinds of things because big news organizations like the New York Times or the Washington Post or ProPublica have done the stories. So it's not as if, we're in the dark completely. But I think, local news organizations and cable TV and network news are kind of ignoring these plans that are being made by Trump and his allies to do some really radical things in a second term. And you set it up beautifully in the introduction to weaponize the Justice Department, to, invoke the Insurrection Act. So if people are protesting in the street, they could send the military out to go after political opponents in a very radical way. I mean, these are things that they continue to sort of chip away at the guardrails of our democracy and could really change the kind of America we live in. So that's so important that I think it should be dominating coverage. And, we hear a lot about the same things all the time. So this is one of the things I think we should start hearing a lot about all the time.
And some of these things are in line with topics that President Trump has talked about before, going after his political opponents, cracking down on protesters. But it seems like here there's a more concerted, coordinated, documented effort going on. Is that part of the reason why this needs to rise to a higher level for the media?
Yeah, I do think it's at a different level. I think in Trump's first term, he came in as an unusual candidate, but all these systems were set up that kind of tended to restrain what he could do. There were, there were longtime public servants, not cronies, in positions. If you think back to the Georgia case in which then President Trump said to the Secretary of State, you need to find me another 11,000 votes. That Secretary of State, who was a Republican, said, essentially said, I don't do that, and refused to do what Trump was asking him to do. But if there's an effort to put, yes men and cronies in all these positions, you may not have a dutiful and conscientious public servant like that who will push back. And it really isn't about party. It's about how people get appointed.
We're talking with Margaret Sullivan right now, Guardian U.S. columnist, about how she thinks the media can do a better job of covering the dangers of a second Trump presidency. You can join in, too, with your questions, your comments. What do you want to see the media do differently when it comes to covering a Trump candidacy? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Margaret, when a news outlet does cover these topics, what are some of the ways you see them perhaps still falling short or missing the mark?
Well, I think that we go into this thing that, sometimes is called false equivalency, or sometimes it's called both sides-ism, which means that we tend to play it safe, too safe sometimes, by equating things that aren't really equal. In other words, we say, in essence, This side of the situation says that it's raining outside, and this side of the situation says, no, it's not. Well, there actually is a truth there, and just having everybody say their thing and not trying to get to the truth of it is a dereliction of duty. So when we do that with politics, and we give everybody an equal say, even if one side is lying, even if one side is anti-democratic, that's actually not how it should work. There's an expression that the famous Watergate journalist Carl Bernstein likes to say, and I think his former partner in crime, Bob Woodward, likes to say, which is get to the closest approximation to the truth that we can. And we don't really get there by equating unequal things. And that is a tendency that the media has because, I mean, for good reason, we want to be fair. We want to be seen as neutral. But sometimes it's not really fair to just go down the middle and equate things that aren't equal.
And in your recent column on this, you point out some of the language that is used in articles about Trump's plans for a second presidency. You use words like pussyfooting around and scaredy cat language. Do you think there's a level of fear of being seen as unfair that kind of leads to some of this both sidesism that you're talking about?
I do. I mean, I experience it myself, you know, and I'm a columnist, so I get to express my opinion. But if people start saying to me, you're a partisan hack or you're a lefty or whatever it may be, I don't want to be seen that way. I want to be seen as a neutral, although opinionated, impartial journalist. So you have, imagine a whole news organization that needs to be seen as fair. And they're getting this criticism, which the right has become very, very skilled at being aggressive about. And so what's the tendency? Well, I'm going to, kind of change the way I'm doing things. Maybe I'll move the whole thing over to the right. But the thing is, it never satisfies. It's set up not to satisfy. So I think the media gets to feeling on the defensive. Journalists get to feeling on the defensive. And the way they cope with it is by doing this kind of false equivalent journalism.
I want to give a listen to an example of a journalist that you say recently got it right when it comes to covering specifically election denialism. Here's a clip of George Stephanopoulos interviewing House Majority Leader Steve Scalise of Louisiana earlier this month on ABC's This Week.
Can you say unequivocally that the 2020 election was not stolen?
Well, what I've told you is there are states that didn't follow their laws. That is what the state constitution, the U.S. Constitution requires. I've seen in my own state where we had to send our elections commissioner to jail years ago for fraud and corruption, and we cleaned up our act in our state. Every state ought to follow the laws that are on their books. That's what the U.S. Constitution says.
That's not what I asked. I said, can you say unequivocally that the 2020 election was not stolen?
Look, Joe Biden's president. I know you and others want to talk about 2020. We're focused on the future. We've talked about 2020 a lot. We're talking about how to get our country back on track, how to get our economy moving, how to stand up to the bad actors around the world.
And that question got batted back and forth several times in that interview, eventually grounding things to a halt. Given that that can be the result of those interviews, what do you see as the purpose of coverage like that?
So I think that, Stephanopoulos did a good job in that he followed up. He followed up and followed up and followed up. He was basically trying to get Steve Scalise to say, to say one way or the other, did he think the election was stolen or did he think the election was not stolen? We know that the election was not stolen. There's no reason to think that it was. And Steve Scalise knows that very well, too. I mean, he went so far as to say, look, Biden's the president. He was giving him that much. But he doesn't want to say the election wasn't stolen because there's a political price to pay for that. And the political price is that Trump would be mad at him. And, Trump has an iron grip on the party to the point where people won't say what they know to be true. So I think it's admirable to follow up like that and try to press for an answer. And if you can't get one, eventually he basically cut off the interview because he wasn't getting a straight answer. And I think I'd like to see more of that.
We're talking with Margaret Sullivan right now, columnist for The Guardian US. We're talking about how the news media have been covering the risks of a second Trump presidency and how they could do it better. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see the media do different, if anything, in covering a Trump candidacy? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up our talk with journalist Margaret Sullivan, now a columnist for Guardian US. She says the news media, national and local, aren't doing enough to warn people about Donald Trump's authoritarian plans for a second term were he to be elected president. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. And we can go to the phones now. We have Nels with us in Denton. Hi, Nels.
Hi. I had a question. She was talking about what can the media do in order to better prepare everybody for, you know, a possible next Trump presidency or the dangers of that. My thoughts on that are just tell the truth. I mean, we went through the whole Russian collusion thing. That was all false. It's been proven as being false. The media jumped all over that. All of the major networks were talking about how they had irrefutable evidence that this happened and it was all a lie. So why don't you just tell the truth? It may be that the majority of the people in America think that Trump would be the best president.
Gotcha, Nels. Thanks for the call. And Margaret, Nels saying that the media can get out ahead of itself a little bit. What do you think?
Well, I think that I actually have to disagree with Nels about the Russia coverage. While it's true that no collusion was proven, there's no question that Russia tried to interfere with the 2016 election. I mean, that's a fact. And, you know, so I think this idea that that was all a hoax and the media is at fault is untrue. Yeah, they probably went a little crazy with the coverage, and I take the point on that. But, you know, by saying just tell the truth, I think that good journalists do that, but there are a lot of choices that get made along the way. What do you emphasize? What goes in a headline? How do you cover something? How much emphasis do you give? And those are the kinds of, I guess, nuances that I'm talking about here.
Another thing I was curious about, Margaret, is the reach of a news story or a news outlet. Sometimes it can seem like the New York Times or whatever outlet you might choose has its baked-in audience. Are there new ways you would like to see newsrooms kind of reaching out to people that might not normally see their coverage?
So one of the things that I find very troubling is that local newspapers and local news in general is in trouble. And I'm so glad that, you know, we have you and other public radio stations like you to get the word out to people. But, you know, with local newspapers being so decimated, it's hard for people to absolutely know what's going on. And we're all kind of in our echo chambers. We're you know, many of us, some are watching this kind of thing. Some are watching that kind of thing. So I think that, you know, those news outlets that are very influential, I'd like to see them work more with local journalists and beef up local coverage as much as they can. I mean, there's so much attention paid to national politics. It would be great for them to divert some of that energy and some of that staff to helping local news outlets do, you know, do their job a little better. And there are also a lot of ways that local journalism can be boosted. For one thing, I think people need to pay much more attention to it and to support their local outlets. So that's really important.
And I'm curious, too, about the local TV news is one place where I know a lot of people get the majority of their news. And there's limited time in the format to cover something as in-depth as this. Sometimes you get a two and a half minute story about the latest political poll. How would you like to see those local outlets, especially TV, cover this kind of stuff?
Right. I think they ought to get their heads together and think about what their coverage is really going to be and to try to move away from that sort of simple horse race coverage. You can do a story about the actual effects of a presidency or the stakes of the election, the consequences. You can do it in a short amount of time. But you have to put some time and energy into thinking about what's our mission here. And our mission ought to be to really inform the public. So when they go to the voting booth, You know, they may not have the same opinion that you or I or someone else does, but they know what they're getting. And I think that's the key to this whole thing.
Now, it's possible that if news media effectively communicate these dangers and reaches all the people they want to, people still might choose Donald Trump. But you write in your recent column that when people understand the risks to their rights, they vote accordingly. Where do you look for evidence of that?
Well, I think we see it in your state and around the country with the restrictions of abortion rights. It turns out that people really didn't appreciate the way those rights were so precipitously removed. And there's been all kinds of, you know, referenda and laws and changes that have resulted from that, because people felt it as, hey, this is the government taking away my rights that have been well established. So I think, of course, abortion rights is it's pretty easy to understand. You know, it's something that everybody can get their head around. I think this business of, you know, the sort of erosion of democracy is a little more subtle, but I still think that we can get it across to people. And when they understand it, I think they will probably be affected by it when they go to vote.
We've got time for, I think, one more call. JJ is with us in Two Rivers. Hi, JJ.
Hi. I was wondering why there's not stricter regulation from like the FCC on being dishonest on news programs. I mean, the reason we're in this position is because channels like Newsmax and One News and even Fox just blatantly and intentionally misinform their viewers. Wasn't the FCC have something, you know, to do about that? I mean, we spend so much time and effort bleeping bad words and blurring nipples. Why aren't we worried about the honesty and integrity of the coverage?
JJ, thanks for the call. Margaret, what do you think?
Yeah, it's a tough question. I'm very reluctant. I mean, I share the feeling that I hate to see lies circulating in the media, but I'm also very reluctant to have the government controlling the press in any way. And I think one form of accountability that we are seeing is in the courts, because Dominion Voting Systems sued Fox News for defamation and ended up with a $787 million settlement. Fox basically had to admit that they lied to the public. And I think that that's probably a better and more promising avenue for some accountability. But it is, I agree, it's very frustrating to see the lack. We feel like there's nothing we can do about this and it has such broad effects. But I'm not sure the answer is for the government to kind of crack down on it.
And Margaret, in just our last minute or so here, you're running a newsroom in 2024, hypothetically. What is your message to your reporters about how to cover the Trump candidacy?
So there's a press critic whose name is Jay Rosen, and he has coined a phrase, not the odds, but the stakes. So I would get across to my journalists, my reporters, what we want to cover here is not the horse race, the odds, but the stakes. What are the consequences if this person's elected? What are the consequences of if this person is elected? And most prominently, what are the consequences if Donald Trump is reelected? How is our country going to change? How are we going to get that across to people in a way that's fair and that's impartial but still is powerful?
We'll leave it there. Margaret, thanks for taking the time and talking with us today.
Thanks. It's a privilege. I appreciate it.
Margaret Sullivan is a columnist for The Guardian U.S., We talked with her about how the news media are covering the Donald Trump candidacy and his more authoritarian goals for a second term as president, and how the media can do it more effectively. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.